5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
When I had come down this hill, I had seen this creature cross the road. It would have ripped my locked door from my truck, extracted me from my vehicle, and there wouldn't have been a damn thing I could have done about it.
This thing, I got to notice in its eyes. Its eyes was real, real evil, real sinister looking. The look it was giving me.
Dad, what are you reporting?
Jesus Christ, you better...
Sheriff?
Deal!
Hello?
Get somebody out here.
What's going on now, sir?
That son of a bitch is about 6'9", I don't know.
Do you see him now, sir?
Yes, I'm looking right at him.
Uh-oh.
Welcome to Sasquatch Chronicles, a place where people share their encounters. Let's start the show. Well, I want to welcome Gary Wayne to the show. He's the author of Genesis 6, How Secret Societies and the Descendants of Giants Planned to Enslave Humankind. And Gary, I really appreciate you being on. I know, as you and I were just talking, the show is mainly about Sasquatch and people's encounters with Sasquatch. And if that's not controversial enough, you know, I thought I'd throw in some religion in there, and maybe maybe next week I'll tackle politics and just see how much controversy I can actually throw into this show. I was very, very fascinated with your research that you've done, because you've done your homework on this topic. I have a lot of questions I want to ask you, but for the audience out there, if you would, could you kind of start from the beginning and just talk about what the Nephilim are? If, assuming no one knows anything about the Nephilim, what are the Nephilim?
Well, the Nephilim, from a Christian perspective, is a race of giants that is spoken of in Genesis 6, and hence the name of the book, the Genesis 6 Conspiracy. And in Genesis 6, it talks about the sons of God, or the angels, going to human females and taking wives of them and creating another race. And so this race was not a normal race. They were considered demigods, and they were giants, and they looked distinctly different. And although the flood was either designed to rid the earth of the flood, and of course all the sins in the society that had gone along with it, they either survived the flood, or there was another procreation after the flood, and they survived the flood. And again, that's kind of where the book starts, is explaining that whole, how they came about and how they survived the flood. And then it goes into, in the last parts of the book, how it affects our contemporary age, and the world we live in today, and end time prophecy. So it spans 6,000 years, and it's a connect the dots investigation into the creation of giants and secret societies that surrounded them and protected them and worked in partnership with them, how they crossed the flood, and what they have to do with the end time. Now, the giants talked about Nephilim, which I also cover in the book, and I'm giving a pretty big fan here right now. I also further that with the mythologies and the religions from around the world. And I weave a very, very common and consistent story that lends credibility to the notions that these giants existed, and that their implications exist to this day.
Yeah, it's interesting. When you read the biblical portion of what the Nephilim were, and you've done a fantastic job with connecting the dots. I mean, there's stuff I've heard you bring up in the past I honestly have never thought of before. But one of the things in there, in the Bible's an interesting book, because if you blink, you'll miss that whole narrative in Genesis about the Nephilim. They don't really tell you what the world was like before the flood. They don't really tell you what was going on before the flood. I mean, you get somewhat of a picture. It was a bad place, but it's very, very brief. When you read the scriptures, it basically, all of a sudden, these angels show up out of nowhere, fallen angels on the earth. They're mating with the women of the earth, and they create these giants. Now, what was the purpose of them doing that? I know that's something some people who maybe don't read the Bible might think, why would they, what is the purpose behind that?
I guess the best way to look at it is there's several conspiracies in prehistory that were going on and that still are playing out to this day. And so the angels that went to the daughters of men, as the Bible states it, and you're very correct, it's very, very meager information there. And that's also why you have to bring in the testimonies from around the world to understand the antediluvian world or the world before the flood, which is why I have a whole section on that part of it. And it tells pretty much exactly the same story, but from a different perspective. So these fallen angels are rebellious angels. They're not the angels that sided with God. So even if you're not a Christian, and the book comes from it from a Christian perspective, everybody is pretty much aware of there's good angels and there's bad angels, and there's a rebellion that was led by Lucifer. And so what I call this mating of fallen angels with the daughters of men, I call it actually the second revenge of Lucifer, and there's actually three revenges that I note in the book. And this is to take away the leadership, the kingship, and the domination of all of the blessings that are awarded to Adam, who in my book I will detail as differently as the people of day six. And so when you talk about having controversial subjects, I'm going to take on contradictions in the Bible that most people either want to ignore or overlook. But what I do is weave a consistent story as to why that makes sense, and it answers a lot of the contradictions and the questions. And so this was to usurp the leadership and to enslave humankind in the times before the flood. And I use the word antediluvian. It's a word that's used for the pre-flood. So if I use that word, people will understand what period I'm thinking of, as opposed to post-diluvian, which is after the flood.
Yeah, and so the main purpose then was to basically corrupt create kind of their own bloodline. It's amazing when you look at the Bible, everything has to do with bloodlines. Yeah. On the Christian side, everything has to do with bloodlines, with the Israelites and, you know, coming from Abraham, down to Jesus. It's very much has to do with bloodlines. And that's what you see with these Nephilim pre-flood. They were kind of trying to screw up the bloodline for Jesus. That was my understanding. I could be wrong. I mean, I don't know.
Well, that is part of the premise of the book, is that ultimately I'll present a story and a narrative that lays things out logically and will make a very, very compelling case that the Antichrist will come forward from the descendants of the Nephilim or the bloodlines of the Nephilim. And so this conspiracy back in the antediluvian period was designed to take away the prized mammal, Adam, and to rule him and probably either keep him either as a slave ongoing or to absolutely annihilate humankind and replace it with their preferred type of humanoid.
Let's go back. If you lived in that time, what was the world like, and what were these Nephilim like that people, when they talk about these giants, and that what was the world like at that time? And then here's the interesting part. I know I'm kind of all over the board on this, but here's the interesting part is you don't necessarily have to be a Christian to really look into this. If you look at mythology, Greek mythology, if you look at the Romans, if you look at the Egyptians, if you look at the Aztecs, if you look at the Native Americans, the narrative's the same. They all tell the same story, kind of like the flood. They all tell the same story on what happened. And so when you look at the Nephilim pre-flood, what was the world like then, and what were these Nephilim like?
Okay, so there's the number of civilizations that are going on in the pre-flood, and from the Christian perspective, it's the Sethites, it's the descendants of the third son of Adam that they mostly focus on, and those bloodlines down through Noah, who survived the flood. But that was one civilization, and they didn't have kings. They were an agrarian people. They pretty much stayed within themselves, even though there was some communication. But then there were all these other civilizations, and so where Cain went over to the other people of day six, there's all of these other people and all these other races that were around the world. And now he didn't, of course, get to all of them likely, but he was certainly part of the Middle East, as I would understand it, in terms of the Sumerian civilization and the Blackheads, as they're known in from historical and mythological perspectives. But you also, when you understand the mythologies of the other worlds, you have civilizations known as Mu or Atlantia or Antediluvian Greece or Antediluvian South America. And all of them had civilizations. And after about sixth generation is when the Nephilim were introduced, although I will also weave in the book that there's possible some other Nephilim, different kinds of Nephilim that were brought in before the sixth generation when the sons and daughters went to the daughters of men to produce these Nephilim. These Nephilim populated in significant numbers and quickly, and of course they had very, very long lives, and the original Nephilim were immortal. Their bodies eventually died, but their spirits remained, but they lived for even longer ages than you see some of the ages that are cited in Genesis, where let's say Noah was about 850 years. Well, they would have the ability to live longer. So from their great size and their great strength and their fearsome look and their warrior attributes and the things that they were taught by their fathers from the fallen angels, they were easily able to dominate the society and set up these kingships. So when you look at the Atlantean Empire, for example, they had 10 different nations within that Atlantean Empire. And they were fathered by Poseidon, who not coincidentally copulated with female humans as well and created 10 twins, all males, and they became the 10 kings over these empires. And so they were very, very militaristic in trying to set up world government. Atlantis in the mythologies was actually known as the helm of world government in that age. Now, these empires were also dominated with another influence, and that's where the secret societies and the different types of religions come in. And what they did was they formed secret societies to protect the knowledge from the fallen angels and the seven sacred sciences that were taught to Adam, then passed on to Cain. And so you have Cain and his descendants, and some of them in some aspects in the research will come out in the book, were thought to be Nephilim as well, but from a previous procreation. They were people that assisted these kings. And so when you look at Atlantean mythology, you have these wizards. Well, that's the religion that was being housed within these secret societies. It was a polytheist religion, or a religion that was not worshiping one god, but many gods. People might also know it as paganism, but I think the better word for it is polytheism. And so all of those mythologies are written outside the Bible from seeing the same events, but talking from it from a polytheist perspective. And so they housed this great knowledge that also helped develop the antediluvian world. So you have this completely different antediluvian world than what you would glean out of the Bible, because the information there is just so stingy. And what happened as they became more powerful, they became more greedy, vengeful, and war was running rampant during the antediluvian age. And so the combined evils of the descendants of Cain and the Nephilim and the war and the bloodthirstiness of that whole sort of period reached the peak, where either God or the gods, depending on which perspective you're coming from, brought on the flood.
Right. No matter what culture you're talking about, if you're coming from a Christian standpoint, God had to step in and wipe the world out. It had gotten so bad and things had became so diluted. One thing you had mentioned in there, you talked a little bit, and again, I might be getting a little bit off topic here, so you can bring me back on topic. But you talked a little bit about what their appearance freaked people out. Was it just their size that freaked people out?
Well, it was way more than that. Size would be one thing, but way more than that. And I'll describe a little bit as to what they looked like. But before I do that, I just wanted to mention one more thing about the antediluvian world. The hubris of the Nephilim became so great that it's recorded in Greek mythology and as well in Atlantean, even though that's a part of Greek mythology, that they actually rebelled against the gods, and they had a war against the gods, and many of them were imprisoned into a place called Tartarus. So not only did they try and wipe out humankind and each other and all these other different things, but they also rebelled against the gods. Now, in terms of their looks, and so they're obviously large. They weren't like a tall basketball player. They were taller than that. You're talking, even if you're talking about in times of diluted bloodlines in the times of Goliath, and depending on whether or not you're talking about a royal span or a common span, it was anywhere from 8 feet to 12 feet. So the original ones were even larger than that. And the breadth of them, they were not slender. They were stocky, built players. They were like a WWF wrestler or a lineman on a football team, muscular, strong, and wide as well as tall. And so their shoulder or their width to height span was quite a bit different than what humans were. So we're basically, our height to width is about a 3-to-1. They were about a 2-to-1. So you can imagine that these were muscular, strong, huge individuals. They also glowed. And so the word shining ones is a very common term in mythology. And even in some of the mythologies and apocryphal books of the Bible, that describe them as shining ones, and their eyes would glow. It would light up a room. And so they were shining like their fathers, like the angels were. They also had long necks. They had long necks like a serpent. Maybe not like 10 feet long, but an extended sort of neck. And their face was like a snake or a viper or a serpent because they looked just like their fathers. They were this snake-like being that shone, that were huge and were monstrous, and they were also very adept. They were fleet of foot. They were quick with their hands. And so these were awe-inspiring, seemingly immortal demigods that dwarfed the humans. They were a frightening beast. But the only way I can describe it is they were frightening. And historians like Josephus said that it was frightening to all of the senses. And you can start to imagine why he would say that.
Everything about them sounds terrifying.
Part of it was that they also had a lot of hair. Now, different colors of hair, red hair, blonde hair, and in other accounts, just hairy in particular. So they were also, hair was a significant part of their trait.
Now that's interesting. So they do mention in other writings that they were hairy?
Yes, and very rough skin. And in most cases, the Nephilim were white rough skin, but there are accounts where there are different colors of the races. So again, one presumes that part of the human traits with some of the other races around the world where they would have procreated, that some of the human traits of skin color would have come about.
I never thought about that before, because you think about the different races and the diluted of that bloodline. I wanted to ask you a question, and I know this probably isn't relative to your research or the Nephilim, but it's a question a lot of listeners have been asking me to ask you. Prior to the flood, was there any sort of DNA manipulation going on with the animals? You know, and the reason why I ask that, I have a few examples for you. In Greek mythology, they talk about like the centaur or the one with the bull, had a head of a bull and a body of
The Minotaur.
The Minotaur. Yeah, they talk about all these freaks that were out running around. in Greek mythology, and actually they talk about it in a lot of different cultures. In your opinion, do you think there was DNA manipulation going on pre-flood with the animals?
Okay, so let me first, yes. The quick answer is yes. So let me start with an interesting piece of the Old Testament Bible where it's part of the law of Moses after the flood, and the law comes down to Moses, and you get into Deuteronomy and these books that explain that the Israelites were not permitted to crossbreed animals, and it's an actual law. That's rather odd, and it's also right in there, right where it has other laws like the drinking of blood and a few other aspects, and worshiping of idols and strangulation of animals, which were all the traits of some of the rituals of the Antediluvian society and the Nephilim. So that's a very odd coincidence. So biblically speaking, there's not much more in there than that. But one concludes from that something must have been going on to require that type of law that the descendants of Noah through Shem and then down to Abraham and forward to Isaac and down to Moses and that whole lineage, that they were to uphold these laws, and there was for a reason. So when we do get into places like mythologies like the Greeks and many around the world, there are all of these freaky, scary, unbelievable type of animal that's recorded all over the world. So one presumes that either they found a way to crossbreed, or they did some form of DNA manipulation to create that. And the centaur, for example, the one that you were referring to, goes to the mythology about the labyrinth and with Theseus and King Minos on the island of Crete. And so this bull actually came from a copulation in the mythology between the wife of King Minos and this bull, and created this minotaur. So that's one possible aspect of how things were done. Somehow they're able to crossbreed and make that successful. Further into Greek mythology, you learn about beings that are created in a cloud, where they go in and something happens within this cloud, and so this being is created, and that's would have been how the centaurs were created. And so that reeks out, if you want to get into not a Christian perspective, but an alien mythos about going into the air or into an alien craft and having these experiments done. And so we have some very clear examples that are written about with that aspect, just as with the Gnostic religion, they talk about some Nephilim being created, the Sethites, Enemenkis Sethites, are another race of not biblically spoken of giants, but a similarly related religion where it takes part of Christianity and then washes it through its polytheist doctrines. But they create a Nephilim race within a cloud called the Sethites. And so there's all of these different things going on. It doesn't matter whether or not you're talking about griffins and or sphinxes and all these different animals that are shown in every culture around the world. There was something going on with either an ability to crossbreed with a technology we don't have, or some sort of DNA application to it. And if you ask me, if you connect into this whole area with this significant technology that is so under-investigated, that was part of the Antediluvian world, that descended from the fallen angels and the seven sacred sciences that were given to them, and the size of the technology in civilizations that they are mythologized to have, it's not a big stretch to say that there wasn't DNA manipulation going on back then.
You know, it's interesting. When you look at, we're taught, we have this science, quote-unquote science, that we're taught today, that we came from monkeys, they created cavemen, and then created us today. And everyone's kind of gone with this idea of evolution, that we have somehow come from monkeys. And it's kind of silly when you really stop and think about it. You know, it's like, really, the moon's in a perfect position to control the tides. The sun's far enough away from the earth. You know, if it was farther away, we'd all freeze. If it was too close, we'd all burn to death. All of these things line up perfect in the world for us. It didn't just happen by just a random something exploded and we all just came from evolution. It just seems silly to me to think that. But it's interesting when you look at some of the old architecture, and it might even be pre-flood that they have uncovered, they'll find stones that we can't even lift with cranes today that appear to be cut with lasers, placed into place with perfect precision, stuff we can't even do today. We couldn't even touch it today with the technology that we have. So when you talk about the pre-flood and probably the advanced technology that they had, it's not too far off to think that they were probably more technology advanced than we are today.
It seems obvious. And what is really difficult today is some of the dogma that is stuck to whether or not it's evolution or the history that we're taught of humankind. It makes no sense that somehow we lost all of this technology, forgot it somehow, some way, and then we had to relearn it. We still are not able to create these monuments that are out there today with the technology and the size of the blocks. And I think everybody's pretty familiar with how amazing some of that is. And we get fed things like the pyramids were created, you know, about 2300 to 2500 BC. He and, you know, Cheops and a few other pharaohs are generally utilized and because they've got an initial on there. But then they ignore all of these, the other evidence that shows the pyramids actually shown in Egypt on many, many other artifacts that are dated from 2900 and before. And so none of it really adds up. It doesn't stand the test of scrutiny. It only does if you want to ignore everything else. And that's not really objective science, and it sounds more like a religion than anything else, or a firm belief in, or a fanaticism in a belief at any cost. And so anything that contradicts that generally is ignored, and it's very frustrating to see that. Trouble is those conclusions don't seem to stand up to any sort of critical analysis or critical questions. And even if you talk about evolution, and you know, Darwin, as an example, never really extended the idea that what he was proposing could resolve all of the issues, because he recognized things like eyes and complicated parts and all of those things happening at the same time it cannot be answered through evolution. And if they ever applied odds and mathematics to these very long odds of all of these things happening, it becomes mathematical zero over and over and over and over and over and over. So in mathematical zero is somewhere between 1 and 3.5 trillion to 1 and 4 trillion. Well, the universe is only 12 to 14 billion years old, and they can extend that to 20 if they want. Doesn't matter. But when you're talking in the trillions and mathematical zero over and over and over and over and over, that happens in all of these things that we see around us, there's a problem in the theory. It's an interesting theory, but it's not fact.
And we can come, I want to come back to the bloodlines and the conspiracy, the Genesis conspiracy that you bring up, because it's a fascinating topic. I was talking to my girlfriend the other day, and I was telling her I had looked this up after I heard you talk about it. And I said, you know, there was this creature that existed at one time. What it would do is they had flying machines, and they would go and they'd kidnap people, take them up into the clouds, and do experiments on them, do something with them, later return the individual back to where they had taken them from. And there was usually a distortion of time. The person was gone for a period of time, and they didn't realize how long they were gone. And I said, they called these things the Greys. And she said, yeah, you're talking about aliens. And I said, no, I'm talking about fairies. And she said, fairies? What are you talking about? She's like, you're talking about Tinkerbell? I said, no. But we talk a little bit about the fairies, and then we can kind of go back to the bloodline discussion. But I found this fascinating because nothing is new under the sun. You know what I mean?
And I'll actually touch on that in the book. I'll spend some time on the alien concept and how it relates, and how the fairies relate. And the fairies is a kind of weaves its way through the book, as do the dragon imageries and metaphors. And so there were several different classifications of fairies as the mythologies bring them down. one of those classifications, and the fourth classification, there's the little people, and then there's two or three or four other classifications of the little fairies, you know, some being like elves and gnomes and trolls, and then there's the beautiful little fairies that you see in like Cinderella and Peter Pan, and then there's one called the Gray Neighbors. And they were gray, actually pretty much an identical description to what we call little grays today. And they did have advanced flying machines. They did kidnap people. They did do experimentation on them. They did lose memories. It's an identical scenario, story, narrative as an alien abduction. And I'll cover a couple of those in the book. And it's actually quite freaky as to how, that parallels what we see or hear going on today, whether or not you believe in an alien actuality or not. It's rather more than coincidental that they're identical. And I guess my explanation for that would be is that we define the aliens and what might be going on out there today from our own technological perspective. And I think people beforehand, before the age of technology, were describing what they saw the best way they could in terms of the culture and the language and the mythologies that they already had. But absolutely true. The little grays, are, out there and in mythology and all over the world and including North American Indians. I haven't found a specific reference to the North American mythologies on little grays, but they have a number of mythologies in almost every tribe in North America, and I found over 40 different names of not only giants, but significant references to the little people or the forest people. And again, if the Flood and the Nephilim are a worldwide myth, then the little people are also part of that worldwide myth because they show up everywhere.
Yeah, and it's disturbing. It's really disturbing because when you read that, it's kind of like my girlfriend's first reaction when she was like, well, that's, you're talking about aliens today. And sometimes when you go back and you look at mythology, you look at Sumerian text, you look at a lot of ancient writings, it's disturbing because there's a lot of it that's true. And even some of the stuff they call it Greek mythology, but Greek mythology, there's always a basis of truth to any myth.
Absolutely. There's some truth that's in there. And what I don't look at as coincidence is that the fairy mythos is everywhere today in our entertainment and our literature. And it's everywhere in the past. It's all over Shakespeare. This is something that shouldn't be taking place unless there was more to it than just, yeah, that's a nice story. But as my research shows is everything to do with fairies has an allegory that is attached to a very long story that weaves its way through our history.
Yeah, and even the description of the fairies is kind of disturbing. The almond-shaped eyes, the larger head, just the way they describe them. I wanted to ask you, so here's a question I posed to some of my audience that may not be Christian that may listen into this. I had asked them, I said, where do you think dynasties come from? Where do you think royalty comes from? Pre-flood with these Nephilim creatures and your Genesis conspiracy, can you talk about that? And then we can talk about after the flood.
So before the flood, all of the kingships of the world, they were awarded kingship from a council. And in Sumerian mythology, that would be Nippur, it would be the center of the earth and other ones where heaven meets earth, but they're all talking about a central location. And that central location created what they call the Ring Lords, or the Lords of the Ring, as Tolkien would bring forward in his retelling of the antediluvian age and some of those animals that you see and the different types of beings. This is the same story. But they were awarded kingship from a council. And so not only were they awarded kingship, but the only kings that were awarded the kingship had their bloodlines or were fathered through the fallen angels or other gods, depending on which religion or perspective you want to come from. So they were all fathered by the gods, and they became the kings and the rulers, and only their bloodlines and descendants would rule thereafter, and they would intermarry to keep those bloodlines pure. So now we have the flood that comes along, and this whole royalty and this whole world is wiped out. But after the flood, we're told that again, kingship and leadership reverted from humankind. It failed in some sort of manner, as it says in Sumerian mythology. And once again, the kingships were awarded from heaven again and again from the center of the earth. And so one takes from that that kingships were again dominated and ruled over by the descendants of Nephilim. Now, through Nephilim that either survived the flood, or there was another procreation to create more Nephilim after the flood. I lean a little bit more to survival, although I do recognize procreation if I recognize it the first time, what happened the second time. And the Bible does say there was Nephilim both before and after the Bible. So if we look at it from a Christian perspective, they did survive. If we look at it from all the other mythologies, they did survive somehow or recreated. And they held these kingships in tight, orderly fashion, and people were not allowed to marry into the bloodlines. They only married within the various kingships that were set up after the flood. So whether it was in Babylon, or it was in Egypt, or it was in various other royal houses throughout the Middle East, they would intermarry to keep the bloodlines pure. And when they wanted to, and they would do that to also make sure that I would suppose that the descendants would still remain healthy. But the second reason they would also bring in females from another kingship was is to start another dynasty. And so all of these kingships before or after the flood, and to this day, they will trace their bloodlines back to the gods.
Pre-flood, we have these Nephilim running around. We have these freaks of nature running around. They're giants. They have, they look reptilian in the face. They have elongated necks and big skulls. As you go down through history, like with the Egyptians, they would say, I'm the son of Ra, or I'm a descendant of Ra, or I'm a descendant of some other god they'll name off. But as you look at some of these humans that were in power, like with the Egyptians, let's take Nefertiti, for example. Nefertiti was kind of weird looking. She had a long, long neck, and she had kind of an elongated skull. And I think even her son, Tutankhamun, had the same physical characteristics as his mother. Were they no longer giants? Or was the bloodline getting so diluted they no longer had the reptilian face? Why the change?
Right. So sometime after the Armana dynasty that you're referring to with Nefertiti and Akhenaten, I think the size of the kings, they start to come down as there's more and more dilution. And I guess the human nature, there has to be some interbreeding, but for the most part, they try and keep those bloodlines as pure as they can. But obviously, there's a closing into how humans look like, or there's a shape-shifting, which is a whole other mythos that takes you in a whole different direction. But their size definitely, unless they can shape-shift into a larger size, has shrunk. And that's just, I think, through the dilution of the time. And over time, there has to be probably some human inbreeding that takes place there. But if you go back to the time of Akhenaten or even the time of Goliath, so let's say year 1000 BC and before, there's still a noticeable size difference between the kings. So Goliath was the king of Gath, and he had four other kings and Philistines that were also giants. And there were also many other giants that lived among the Philistines, and they were known as Avites. And so one presumes then that Akhenaten, when his son Tutankhamun, or any of the other people of the four that reigned during the Armana dynasty, were also larger, because translations, as you're coming into the age of, let's see, even around 2000 BC and before and afterward, the king was kind of a translation of a word of a large man or a giant. And that generally came out of Mesopotamia, where that linkage comes from. Now, if you were to take the time and go through and visit to the King Tut museums that go on display have a very good look at Akhenaten. There's some very good representations of him in those museums and sculptures. And if you look at that one in particular, and it just floored me when I looked at the one I visited in Seattle a couple of years ago. I mean, that's a face of a snake. Not quite 100% identical, but when you look at that, you take a step back and say, whoa.
Yeah, kind of the larger eyes and kind of
long chin and high cheekbones. And yeah. In a lot of those images of those kings, they would also have that long cone head cap to help emulate probably that elongated skull that would have been part of their forefathers.
Yeah, and we see that throughout history. You know, even going back, you're right, I guess there was still giants. I know the with the Bible, it does talk about giants or the Nephilim before the flood and after the flood. And when you read when the Israelites enter into Canaan, if you don't really know anything about the Nephilim, you don't really, because the Bible, like I said, you blink of an eye and you miss it. But as they go into Canaan, they were pretty ruthless. And if you think they were on God's side, you look at it and you go, man, God's kind of merciless on going into like Jericho, or how they dealt with the Amalekites, or how they dealt with these different tribes that were in the area. But if you go in with the mindset that there's a bloodline issue going on here and they have the blood of the Nephilim, you kind of get a clear picture on why God is so merciless on this group of people that is in the promised land.
It is definitely part of the narrative that nobody really looks at from the right perspective in terms of conquering the promised land. So let me back up a little bit and sort of help frame this for the audience. So if you go back to mythology and also Deuteronomy 23, in prehistory there was a division up of the world into certain empires or divisions for people to rule over, and they would have been ruled over by the Watchers. And so Atlantis would have been one of those civilizations, for example. And so it says the sons of Israel there, but Israel wasn't created in the antediluvian period. So if you look at the bottom, let's say in the New International Version, it'll say sons of God, which if you go to other places in the Bible where it has sons of God, like say in Job in three different locations, it'll say sons of Job as asterisk or angel, as they're also known as. And so you understand that the world was divided up amongst the Watchers, but God kept back the promised land as his own. And so if there was this war in the antediluvian age and God did try and wipe out or at least limit the control of these giants and permitted to let things play out after the flood, then the giants knew which land they were going to wait in ambush for, because they knew God wasn't done and his plan wasn't done. And so they waited there in ambush for the Nation of Hope, as the Bible would look at them as, coming along and taking back the land and living in the land of God. Now, there are so many names of nations in the Old Testament that people don't associate with giants. And so, again, everything that's written in the Bible is important, and it has meaning, and when you glance over, you glance over meaning. And so when you start tracing some of these names back, almost all of the nations that they were fighting were either giant nations or nations absolutely infested with giants, and or hybrid giant human nations. And so that war, I call it the Nephilim Wars, as one of the chapters in my book, and I cover that off. And before I get there, I lay the case out for who these people are, how I determine them as being giant nations, and that is the context for the conquest of the Promised Lands.
Yeah, it's interesting. I know you had a theory. The Bible talks about King Og. What is your theory on King Og? Do you think he survived the flood? He was known as a giant.
Again, in Deuteronomy, it says he's, depending on which translation that you're looking at, in Deuteronomy 3, I believe it is, it says that in brackets in the text, not as a notation, but actually in the text, that he is the remnant or the last survivor of a race of giants. Well, that's a very odd notation. So if we understand that he was Rephaim, and I can come back to that in a second and explain the linkage between Anakite, Rephaim, and Nephilim. He was an Amorite, but an aboriginal Amorite, the last of one of these giants. But giants survived afterwards. So what is it referring to there? Well, likely it's referring to he was one of the last of the surviving giants from the flood. And again, in Hebrew mythology, there is lots of mythologies of Og surviving the flood, and lots of interaction with Abraham and Nimrod and all these other interesting individuals that people often overlook in the early portions of the Bible. So if you look at connecting back some of these people to Nephilim, it says Anak is a descendant of Nephilim. And further on, and there are in other parts, it'll say Anak and Rephaim. Anak come from, are part of the Rephaim. So if you take that back, go Anak, Rephaim, to Nephilim as a direct relationship back to Nephilim. So then it's only a question of is were they Nephilim before or from after the flood.
Now you talk about the sacred sciences, the seven sacred sciences. Can you explain that? I've never heard that before, and I know you talk about Cain being given knowledge, the biblical Cain being given knowledge, occult knowledge that was passed down. It's passed down from Cain. Can you talk a little bit about what the sacred sciences are and what?
Sure. You would know them today as arithmetic and astronomy and rhetoric and music and things like that. So it's a broad term in terms of the sciences that were provided. Now, these sciences were given to Adam in Eden, as the legends go. Now, this part, it does explain some certain aspects of some of the descendants of Cain that the Bible says, but this part's not in the Bible. This now comes from the secret society's own information. So, the particular secret society that I am talking about in this case will be Freemasonry or the Masonic organization. Now, there are a number of other ones. People know the Rosicrucians and several other, the Illuminati, and they're all related, and they're different sort of hierarchies into this secret society. But what people don't know is that these secret societies all profess to own secret ancient knowledge, knowledge that comes from before the flood. And they have all of these legends that they keep within these secret organizations and actually have books on it. They're difficult to get, but you can get them, that tell, and again, an extraordinarily similar story as the Bible and other mythologies, but this time from a Cain descendant perspective. And as I alluded to earlier, that it was the Cainites that received this knowledge, and then later the Nephilim described in Genesis 6 were created, they had this knowledge before and it was being developed. And so they were in partnership with the Watchers or the Dark Angels. And if you're from an alien perspective, well, then it would have been the aliens. But it's all the same sort of mythos, story, narrative. I don't care which direction you come from. They talk about the patriarchs of Freemasonry as Cain, Enoch, son of Cain, not son of from the line of Seth, but Enoch, second son or first son of Cain, as being the founders of ancient masonry. And it goes through to Lamech and their daughters that had this antediluvian revitalization in the sixth generation of all of this knowledge. So it was kept housed and secreted, and they started their own these religions to the Watchers that they worshiped. The polytheism that we see around the world today and all the different gods, it's all the same religion. But all of this is now housed in these secret societies and these mystical religions that people would recognize as mysticism. And so not only do secret societies and mysticism have initiation, as not being a coincidence, as it is what it's telling you, it's the same religion and they house the same information. And so they were initiated and ascended a ziggurat, a ladder, three levels, 33 levels. There's a whole bunch of different allegories as they climb this ladder of knowledge to to learn all the secrets of the universe. But this had to be protected from the mundane masses because they felt the information was so powerful it could destroy the world. And so all of this works in tandem with the Nephilim, the power of the Nephilim, and the institutions that they created, and weave their ways all through history. It's why the book is 800 pages. It takes a long time to connect these dots and lay out how all of this happens. But what's important is that this knowledge was developed to levels that the Bible doesn't describe, but to incredible levels before the flood and all through the descendants of Cain.
I don't know if we're talking about one and the same here, but I know like in the book of Enoch, it talks about the angels coming down and they all had different names and they were all good at one was good at, you know, he knew warfare really well. He knew how to create weapons. One knew the stars really well. One knew mathematics, so on and so on and so on. Is that kind of what the same thing we're talking about here? Just at
that
a bigger level?
That would be in addition. And so, there was what is known at in the book of Enoch and other testimonies similar to Enoch that this was illicit knowledge from heaven. So it probably took the existing knowledge to a whole new level.
I gotcha. And so hence secret societies, which makes sense why there would be secret societies.
And these secret societies have been with us and in partnership with these kingships all along. So if you look at, let's say ancient Egypt and you have Pharaoh. What do you have beside them? You have these priests that are very powerful in control of the religions and they're almost working in tandem and they have all of these great, sorcery capabilities and magic capabilities. You go back to Atlantis and you look at, the wizards that were there and the magic. And if you look at Lord of the Rings and the wizards that are in there, it's that type of relationship, that type of magic, that type of power, that type of religion. And again, that is played out in King Arthur, where you've got King Arthur, which again, I'll touch on, and how that allegory works into recording the continuation of that set of fairy bloodlines. But you'll have Merlin as well. So you have a Knights of a Round Table, just like we talked about the Lord of the Rings. You have a king that mythologized to go back to giants and is a solar deity. And now you have a round table of knights, which is the Lord of the Ring of the Lords, the ring of the Lords, however you want to use that analogy. And now you have Merlin, which is the religious side and the powerful side and the enchanting side. So again, we see this sort of partnership that works not only from the beginning of the mists of time, but right through our history, and we see that in our entertainment today.
Not much is new under the sun from the past until today. It's kind of disturbing, really, when you take some of the information, things going on today, simple thing like the fairies you and I talked about, the greys that had flying machines that took people, and then you see alien stuff. You know, people talk about aliens today. The story, the narrative really hasn't changed a whole lot. From the beginning, pre-flood, we have these giants, they have long necks, the Nephilim, just freaks of nature, running around, basically ruling the earth. They have advanced technology. Finally, at some point, God says enough is enough, and he wipes them out. They show up after the flood. It's interesting how they show up after the flood. We don't really have to get into this if you don't want to, but it's interesting. There's people that show up after the flood that don't appear to be from Noah's sons, that don't fall into any genealogical timeline with Noah's sons, but these people just tend to show up. Then these dynasties are created, people that claim to be from the gods, and they're in power and they're royalty. When you look at some of the skulls today that they're digging up with these elongated skulls, the way the skulls is sutured together, it's not like a human skull. Do you think we're digging up Nephilim skull?
I think so. It's amazing how these skulls all disappear. There's so much evidence that is written about them, but we can't actually get our hands on many of these skulls to see how prevalent that they were. And, you know, there's on Facebook, there's a number of sites that track discovery of these elongated skulls in newspapers in the 1800s and the early 1900s. And they've created this big library of it, but they seemingly they all go to the Smithsonian or they mysteriously disappear, but they're all recorded in these newspapers. There's incredible amount of written discoveries of these elongated skulls that are out there. And for me, although I guess, you know, it is a bit speculative, but from my perspective is it can only be from descendants of these giants who had these large elongated skulls. And I understand that many of the humans would try and emulate that afterwards or at that time, and they would bind their heads and try and create that elongated look. But these skulls that are being dug up aren't just human-sized skulls in most cases I'm referring to, although you're going to find some human skulls that will have that elongated effect. But these are larger. These are completely anatomically different. You know, they don't have those sutures on the back, and they're so much larger. Josephus, you know, at the time of around 70 CE to 100 CE, and after he was captured by the Romans, he actually writes about the history of the Jewish people so that doesn't get lost. And in it, he records that even up to his time, they would keep on display these bones of these giants. And they were completely different from a bone structure and size and shape than a human being.
The part that's interesting is why emulate something? Why are people emulating this? And with the skulls that they've pulled, I know some of the skulls that they have uncovered, the volume of the skull, like you said, is larger. Now, if you want to bind a head and alter a skull, you can do that when a child's young. But the one thing you can't do is add volume. And these skulls are just different than a normal human being. So as you go through history, and we're going through the bloodlines, do you want to talk a little bit about, let's say from now we're after the flood, and we have these different dynasties that are in power that claim to be direct descendants of the gods. And you can find this in every culture. But as you go through history, what does that bloodline mean for us today?
What does it mean for us today? Is those bloodlines still exist, and those are mainly the royal families, whether or not they are still in power today or not. Certainly the most obvious one for us would be the English monarchy. And even though they came over as the Hanovers in around 1700, just shortly thereafter, probably the mid-1750s, they still take their lineage back to giants and the descendants of some of the descendants of Noah that they would claim to be giants and not Sethites, which is, again, a whole new other avenue that I'll talk about in the book, later in the book. And whether and if you have the French dynasty, which is no longer there, even though there's descendants of the Merovingians that are out there as well as the Stuarts, they will also take their bloodlines back to the descendants of giants. And if you talk about any, whether it's the Spanish monarchy or any of the limited ones today, they, or the Habsburgs who aren't in power, again, they track their genealogy. And these royal families, they have genealogists that they've had in place for millennia to prove their genealogy. They're just not throwing this thing out. They actually can back it up, and it's my belief they will in the not-so-distant future.
For everyone out there listening, kind of a general idea, the purpose really of the Nephilim, from what I'm understanding, is not only to dilute the bloodline, they were doing weird stuff prior to the flood, they were also put in positions of power over basically rulers over the earth is basically what the Nephilim, their main job was. And it's coming down even into today.
And if we take biblically that the end times will be like the days of Noah, then we have to anticipate somehow, some way either through the descendants or DNA manipulation or crossbreeding of fallen angels and humans again, there will be a resurgence of the Nephilim influence in the end time. I think there might be some of that. I think it's more the descendants, and through the descendants of these giants is they're going to make a case through their religions that they fostered over the years in the secret societies that once they bring about universal religion in world government, they will introduce the Antichrist who will come from their bloodlines and will be the leader of the world.
Now, the world prior to the flood was a freak show. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
I know, and again, if you believe in the Bible, it basically says that there's always a meaning to what's being said. And what's interesting is when they talk about the end of days, they say it'll be like the times of Noah. And what does that mean? You know, when people read that, they kind of glance over that. But what do they mean, like the times of Noah? How is that relevant to what's going on today as what was going on in the past? I wanted to ask you, I know you don't go too much into the alien phenomena. I know you touch on it. Do you think the, quote unquote, the alien phenomenon, as we've talked with fairies and everything else, do you think it's more of this demonic influence going on as opposed to real beings traveling from 3 million miles away and visiting the Earth?
So the alien mythos is it's a very interesting phenomena in mythology. And part of the mythos is that these aliens travel to our dimension through portals. And just as we're discovering through string theory, there's possibly multiple dimensions that are out there, and there's a possibility that these portals exist. Well, just as in fairy mythology, they have what they call fairy mounds or shays, or if you go into the King Arthur mythology, they've got the Ladies of the Lake. Again, these are fairies. And they protect these portals to the other world or the nether world or Anwen. And so I think if the alien mythology is actually true, and there's so much going on, there's something going on, it's hard to know exactly who they are and what they are, but if we do include the little people, and we do include that before the flood, that there was all these other types of beings, including the little people, and all the mythologies that track these people throughout time and keep that presence and that knowledge alive, it's possible that some of those beings have continued to live and travel through these portals. And it's interesting, again, how all of those mythologies come together with the same narrative. Again, looked at from different perspectives, but kept alive and is somehow affecting not only our world today, but our parents' world and their parents' world, and who knows how far back. But seemingly, there's a possibility that this is more than just a demonic delusion. Not that fallen angels couldn't shapeshift, because, again, in a lot of mythologies, that's a possibility. I think it's a combination of fallen angels, the demons that are still floating around, and for those who may not be aware, and I'll detail them in the book, the demons are actually the immortal spirits of the bodies of the giants that died out, and they're not allowed into heaven, and so they're part of the false gods, they're part of the evil that goes on in the world, and then the fallen angels are a separate group altogether. So if you look at all of that and these possible other beings, and that there might be dimensions and there might be portals, then it sort of all comes together, but all working for the same cause. And again, I look at, you know, some of these mythologies that everybody's familiar with today, like the Lord of the Rings, and at the end, you see all of these beings sailing away on a ship. Because now it's the age of man. Well, where do they go? And why do they happen to be the little people and some of these other bizarre beings that, you know, history doesn't have a record of?
When you look at the alien phenomenon, and I've never heard that difference between demonic and fallen angels. I always assumed we're talking about one and the same. But when you talk about the alien phenomenon and you hear people who claim to have been taken, and experimented on, one of the common narratives that you'll hear constantly from these people is that there's some sort of breeding program going on. And they'll say that there was a hybrid that was created and they were shown their hybrid while taken up into these crafts. And it's interesting, too, when you look at mythology, how people being kidnapped would be taken up into the clouds. Something was able to be created up there, and then they were brought back down. It's just, it seems like the same story. It doesn't seem to me that we're actually talking about alien beings from, you know, millions and millions of light years away. It kind of seems like the same story to me that you're hearing over and over and over again. We're just giving different titles, you know, whether you say fairies or whether you say aliens or you're just giving it different titles. I wanted to ask you, so do you think, have you ever heard of a story called Rachel's Eyes?
No.
I'll have to send it over to you. It's pretty interesting. It talks about this hybrid being, and this, it's too long of a story to go into now, but it's an interesting story. It has to do with the government that had this hybrid being. It was called Rachel. And the real short version of the story is, she was put into, this is back in the, I want to say the 60s or 70s. She was put into this school and her roommate was blind. She was a general's daughter. And when they brought Rachel to this, school, this blind girl was specifically picked out to be a roommate with Rachel. One day the mother came over, and said, yeah, there's some weird things about her. She has to eat certain food that the government drops off. And the mother said it was like this green goo that she ate. Long story short, she gets to talking to her daughter, asking her about Rachel, and her daughter saying, well, she's a little awkward. She's a little weird. She's very monotone when she talks. She's not, you know, and pretty soon Rachel comes in and she always wore a jumpsuit and she always wore glasses and she had this kind of a scarf thing over her head. She had forgotten something. She ran in real quick to grab something and on her way out, she almost fell. The mother goes to catch her and grabs her wrist and says that it was like grabbing a sponge and that she was very pale. Well, when she almost fell, she said that she was different because it's not like, you know, when we go to fall, we try and catch ourselves. Well, she was falling, but wasn't even bothering to catch herself. And as a mother caught her, the sunglasses fell down from Rachel's face and the mother said it looked like snake eyes. And what she was looking into appeared to be like serpent eyes. And she said her skin was real weird looking. It was real pale. She had kind of a longer neck and kind of a bigger skull. She just looked like a freak. It's a very, very fascinating story to listen to. And that made me think of the return of the Nephilim today. What do you think the Nephilim today is going to be?
Well, I think whether or not they're descendants or their DNA manipulated by fallen angels or aliens, or if their DNA manipulated by humans, with, you know, to further enhance the abilities of the royal families, whatever the manipulation or the copulation to produce new ones are with fallen angels, I think what we are going to see is an emergence of a ruling class. And as we see the world come together in 10 trading blocks or spheres of influence or economic zones, whatever you want to call them, that's really where the world is going to head, is they're going to be led eventually by 10 representatives. And these representatives, I believe, will be either the bloodlines or the descendants or the DNA manipulated or the hybrids. They'll be the ruling class of this empire that actually make the way for the Antichrist. So it will play out. What I can't say is exactly how it will happen, but one of those ways, or maybe some of each, will be part of the recipe for that to happen.
What's interesting is when you look at the ruling class today, they're all kind of related. I mean, the bloodlines there, they're all kind of semi-related, and they can trace themselves back to the ruling class. George Bush, he's a direct descendant of Vlad the Impaler, but all of these different ruling classes can trace themselves back with genealogy. So genealogy seems to be very, very important to the ruling class we see today.
Exactly. And then there's degrees of how pure those bloodlines are and how ennobled they are. And so there's different levels of that. So you see the ruling presidents in that. And yes, the Bushes have said that they descend back to Vlad. What's interesting about that is Vlad was part of Ordo Draconis, which was an organization that was formed in the 1400s to reassert their bloodlines and control into Europe for the kingships. And Ordo Draconis is just another word for dragon and Dracula. And Vlad the Impaler, of course, is the character that was used to create the Dracula story in the modern vampire myth. So, I mean, those are not coincidences. Even more importantly is, and there's, I think I've got it on my Facebook still, where there was this 12-year-old student who traced the family tree of all the presidents back, and they all go back to the Plantagenet dynasty of England. And the king of England at the time who signed the Magna Carta. And again, if you go into the Plantagenet and you take that back to the Merovingians, that take that back to the various kingships of the Middle East, you see this more evidence of how they value those genealogies all the way back.
Everyone we have in power today, they can usually trace themselves back to even pre-flood.
To even the pre-flood, yes. I believe they can, because again, sources I use, he writes significantly from secret society perspective and the royal family perspective as a genealogist, and he links their royal bloodlines right back to the Nephilim kings of the antediluvian epoch.
In the book, you talk about dragons and serpents, and we talk a little bit about that. For people out there who are going to buy the book, will you describe a little bit about why dragons were so important? I know today we think of dragons and we think of them as some mythological creature, but we were just talking about Vlad the Impaler or Dracula. And, you know, I think that's what Son of the Dragon. What significance does a dragon play in all of this?
Okay, so dragons and serpents are pretty much in all the old cultures, and they're still quite prevalent today. Everybody knows what a serpent and a snake is, and we can see that. But the dragon can't actually prove itself to be existed. But yet, again, it's in every culture. So let me just link a few things in here, and you'll understand why, from everything else that we talked about, that these royal families and the old dynasties are filled with dragon-like images and serpent images, and why it was so important. So the first thing to remember is, as we said, the watchers or the seraphim angels had the face of a snake, and they fathered the Nephilim. And in the beginning, these Nephilim looked just like their fathers. So there's this sort of hearkening back to that look from a snake-like look. Now if you put a pair of wings on that watcher, now you have a winged serpent or a type of a dragon. And that's why the Sphinx and those other images are everywhere in prehistory, because they're talking about seraphim angels and or cherubim, and they're all a different type of a dragon. And in antiquity, the dragon and the serpent were considered the same animal. Now, if we move forward a little bit, we move to the Eden incident, where the serpent deceives Eve and Adam, and they eat the apple, and from the tree of knowledge, or the tree of gnosis, or the knowledge of the sciences, as the mystical religions will refer to. So the punishment of the serpent was to have its feet and its hands and its wings and everything removed. And so there was many different types of dragons at that time. Some had wings, some did not. But all of those were removed in the Bible accounting, and as it is accounted for around the world in other mythologies. And so at that point in time, the physical type of animal that we would think of as a dragon disappeared. Now, this serpent that was in Eden was not like the snake as we know it crawling on the ground, because it has hands and legs, but it was a little bit bigger than a human. and it was an intelligent being. And so again, now we have a reference to another intelligent type of being that was serving Adam at that time, and a being that looked like a snake or a dragon or a Nephilim or a seraphim angel. And so it was actually, from mythology, the serpent was the king of the animals at that time, whom Adam actually was replaced as inheriting the earth and being over all of the animal kingdom. So again, you can see why all of this imagery now flows through those the bloodlines that say we worship the fallen angels or the dragon angels, and that whole imagery is kept alive throughout the ages because, let's face it, the people in power, the royal families, the dynasties, they had all the wealth and nurtured what was going to be written and how it was going to be written.
Yeah, they worship the dragon. You see that in a lot of Asian cultures, how they worship the dragon. And you always wonder, well, what the heck is a dragon? Why do they worship the dragon? But it makes a lot of sense with your description. It makes me think of our healthcare symbol. Isn't our healthcare symbol?
And I will cover that off in the book. and you've got two different symbols there, but they will now combine Hermes, and that also brings into the seven sacred sciences, and you've got the coiled serpents going up the caduceus of Hermes, and that's another subject in itself.
Yeah, no, I was just sitting here thinking about that. You know, I was thinking, doesn't our healthcare symbol look like a staff with wings on it and two serpents, you know?
And veterinary have a very similar motif as well. Going back there, I mean, there's a significant relationship between medicine coming from the seven sacred sciences and the secret societies all the way through that links through the Great White Brotherhood, the Great White Brotherhood dating back from the time of Nimrod, and that then was transplanted and rejuvenated into Egypt. Medicine was a huge part, and all of that went down through the Essenes. And again, I will cover and lay out how all of this flows through in the relationships in the book.
The book is called The Genesis Six, How the Secret Societies and the Descendants of the Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. Available on Amazon, Kindle. I know you have a website coming, Gary. Get it at Walmart. There's a lot of different outlets. It's kind of written a story within a story, which I like. You know, as one chapter kind of ends, the next chapter kind of picks up on where you left off. I wanted to ask you, have you heard of this World Bank, Karen Hoodies? I'll give you her quick resume, and then you can tell me. I know this might be outside of research that you've done for the Nephilim, but I thought it was a fascinating. Karen Hoodies, she worked as a lawyer for the World Bank from 1986 to 2007. She got her law degree at Yale University. She studied economics at the University of Amsterdam. She worked for, I believe, the Export Bank in the early 80s. So she has this long, long resume. And I was watching this thing the other day that she had come on and basically was trying to be a whistleblower talking about the World Bank and how that our world really isn't being ruled by who we think it's being ruled by. She talks about this homo compensus, is what they call the homo compensus. And basically what it is she claims that these beings are in charge of all of the money in the world. They're in charge of the world power, what happens in the world. And it sounds like crazy talk, but she doesn't come out because I don't think she has any knowledge about the Nephilim, but she talks about these homo compensus, and she said they're not human. It's a different species. And the way she describes them is a lot like what you and I have been talking about. She says they have it has this huge elongated skulls. They have longer necks, and they kind of look like a serpent. For better or worse, it kind of looks like a serpent. And I guess she claims that one of these things showed up at the World Bank meeting. It was a private meeting that they were doing, and it freaked everyone out when this thing had shown up. And it made me think of what we're talking about here, the Nephilim. Whether the story's true or not, it'd be odd for a woman with the long resume that she has and the education that she has would come out with such crazy talk. But what she was talking about was this weird being showing up to the World Bank private meeting and freaking everyone out because it looked like a complete freak. And they call it Homo compensis. And it made me think, I mean, have you heard of that before? And do you think that's related to what we're talking about?
I've heard of it. I don't spend a lot of time on the sort of the lizard people aspect of it, although it is significantly related. I think if there is a relationship there in terms of the bloodlines and that secretive snake sort of imagery, and they would have to have the ability to do shapeshifting, and shapeshifting is part of this whole mythology and literature that goes throughout the ages that the original fallen angels have when they come into this dimension. So it's a possibility, but I have not spent a whole lot of time on that. But what is also relevant, though, is how important the World Bank is and the banks of the world are and who owns the banks and the bloodlines of those people who control all of that. And again, that's what my book gets into, but I don't go down the street into, that's a whole different genre and sort of mythos. I'm aware of it. I'm also aware of this person's testimony. We don't know whether it's misinformation or actually true because they're very good at sending out misinformation. So, you know, it's hard to vet that sort of thing unless you're actually there with, you know, and seeing it yourself. But, you know, I won't rule it out. It's certainly a possibility. Certainly, if not from an actual physical nature, from an allegorical nature, no doubt about it.
So prior to the flood, we have these angels coming down, fallen angels, evil beings coming down, materializing, and creating this weird race of giants. Was that something taken away after the flood to where they were no longer able to do that? Or was it limited? Because it seems like, well, the flood came, why not just have them go do it again?
Well, and some people fall into the belief that they actually did procreate again after the flood. What happened to the ones before the flood? And so it did happen again after the flood, as for the explanation as to how giants were both before and after the flood, would be is the fallen angels that procreated before the flood, they were locked away into a place called the Abyss for their punishments, for their violations against creation. And so one presumes then if that was the punishment of the ones before, then if they did procreate after the flood, then they also would have been locked away. Now, not all fallen angels are locked away. Only the 200 that we know of who procreated before the flood, and then if there were some other ones afterwards, would be. So there are still fallen angels that were part of the angelic rebellion that aren't in the abyss. But again, when we link that back to the end time and the prophecy, is as we go to Revelation, we understand that the keys to the abyss will be open, and these angels will be once more free to cause the same form of havoc that they did before the flood.
So the Genesis conspiracy really has to do with this demonic bloodline and people in power from the beginning of time until today.
Yes, has a contextual layers to it. So you've got the conspiracy of the fallen angels, you've got the conspiracy of the demons who no longer have the bodies, and you've got the descendants of the giants. And this conspiracy flows throughout from the beginning and right till the end of this age, all trying to dominate and enslave humankind and prevent us from fulfilling our destiny. And that will be played out if you're a Christian and you're a believer in sort of the Bible literally as I am, that will play out in the end of days and what we know as Armageddon with the world government and the wars and the destruction that takes place then. I did want to underline that you had touched on it earlier that the Bible records all of these peoples right after the flood, that they come right out of nowhere. And if you're a Christian, that's hard to accept because you accept it totally literally, that everybody was destroyed except for Noah and his family. And so I also have to take on all of the contradictions of the Bible just as the 6,000 years from Adam and a whole bunch of other things. And I will explain all of that as we go through the book. But getting back to these people that survived, they're just incredible amount of people that you can't take them back through the table of nations in First Chronicles or Genesis back to the survivors of Noah, and they come out of nowhere. And there's even ones that are inserted into the table of nations, like the lords of Edom, whom the descendants of Esau married into, that absolutely came out of nowhere. And so I will explain that and link that when I get into that portion of the book, and I think people might find that fascinating. And then I will bring that full circle at the end of the book so they really understand the meaning of what was going on then and how it comes through in terms of why that's important and the full Genesis 6 conspiracy.
When you read just the Bible, you're like, well, who are these people that just come out of nowhere? You know what I mean? They just seem to come out of nowhere after the flood, and they don't really, and it's, when you read the Bible, especially in the beginning, there's a bloodline there. You can tell who came from who and whose grandfather was who, but then all of a sudden these other races, you know, these other humans come out of nowhere. As I'm really glad that the book describes where they come from.
Yeah, I will talk about that, and I will also talk about a number of other contradictions, and I will take that on, and ultimately I'll take on the biggest sort of wedge is how can the Bible be accurate and literal if you think the world is 6,000 years old? You know, maybe that's a possibility, but I think if you accept that, then the Bible is in contradiction in itself. So I will walk through Genesis. And it won't happen at the beginning of the book. I will hint at it as I go through, but at a certain point, I will re-explain the 6 days of creation and separate the descendants of Adam from the time frame before that, because if you know, we can't ignore what science has to say completely. There's things that are obvious. So the Bible is either accurate or it isn't. So I will give a sort of a complete re-understanding of Genesis. And I'll also take away the contradictions as to the obvious ones like people will talk about in Genesis, like who did Cain marry. I will address all of that.
I got a question for you, and we can leave this part out, Gary, if you want. And I've always, it's a question that I've always wondered about. So when Cain was kicked, and again, this is just a, could be a separate thing between you and I. I thought I'd ask you though, because it's always fascinated me. When Cain was kicked out after killing Abel, the Bible's very specific. He was given some sort of mark that he would be protected by. After, you know, he would wander the earth, but he'd be protected by. They never really talk about what that mark is. And again, some of the things in the Bible, they just, if you blink, you'll miss it, but they give specific things. Do you know what that mark was, or do you have a theory on what that mark was?
Yeah, and I'll explain that in the book. but I will say, you know, you have to take into account secret societies. In this case, the Rosicrucians, and one of the ways that they arrived at their name, they would call it the Rosy Crucis is the mark. And it will have it may not have been the mark, but that's the mark that they believe it is. And it's a mark that, they symbolize today throughout their secret societies. But I think I'll leave that for the readers of the book to read and find out.
I gotcha. Okay. Well, fair enough.
But it does have to do with snakes and dragons.
Some of the things you read and some of the things, you know, it's just so
And again, if you look in that instance, is protect himself from who?
Right. Who's coming to kill him?
Yeah. I mean, there was just Adam, Eve, and Abel and Cain, and Cain had already killed Abel. Seth wasn't even born yet, and there were no other sons and daughters born to Seth till 130 years after Seth was born.
So are you thinking that the Cain was involved with the Nephilim or with the fallen angels? And we can leave that for the book. You can just answer yes or no.
In part, yes.
Well, I wanted to get your take on Sasquatch.
For people who don't know, I mean, I grew up in Canada, and Sasquatch is the name that we grew up with, and it's a very common known subject and myth that's out there, and I'm a bit agnostic on it, but I'm more leaning to more the possibility than not, and here's why, even though it's hard to get actual evidence on it. What people maybe don't realize, and maybe your listeners and viewers are more in tune and more learned than most people, but the Sasquatch, Bigfoot, Yeti mythos is not just limited to a little bit North America. It is a worldwide mythology, and it has that mythology right up to this day. So I will call it a mythos, even though we can't prove it from Canadian or American or scientific sort of standards, where if we don't actually see one that's alive, we're not going to believe it. But it's alive and well in all continents around the world. And I don't care whether or not you're talking about Australia. They've got the Yowie in Australia, and it's got several other names like Yahoo and Bunyip and a whole bunch of other names over there. And in Africa, there is Eastern, Central, and South African, and the Fudu, and the Wadabebajan, and the Wild Man. And so this is, in whether it's the Elma in Russia and in Sweden, and the Wild Man in Europe, this is a mythology that goes back into the mists of time. It is not a standalone North American sort of phenomena. So that's the first thing that sort of gets my attention. And even though I'm not an expert in the subject, and I didn't go that far down, it had this very, very worldwide common mythology, like the flood, like the giants. And then when I connect that back to different animals that might have been roaming the earth before the flood. But again, the connection is that these wild men, and they're known as wild men and forest people around the world as well, which is another uniqueness that strikes me as not coincidental, but they tend to live in treed areas and mountain regions and live in either holes or in caves, which again is very similar to the Shea and the fairy mound and the portal sort of aspect. And that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to get evidence on them. Another aspect is they have to be intelligent, otherwise we would find them. But the most compelling thing is about, for me, about the possibility of all of this being true is that I take, whether it's indigenous tribes in North America or indigenous tribes around the world, that they keep their history within their mythology, and they say they are alive today. I don't believe that that is a made-up mythology. I don't believe that North American Indians have over 40 different names for the Bigfoot. And so it's just not the Northwest. They have names and mythology about this through most of the tribes in North America. I find it odd that they would have legends about the little people and the forest sprites and common through, again, pretty much all of the tribes. I find it not coincidental that they have recollections, North American tribes have recollection of the flood and the giants that lived before the flood, and that they were wiped out, and that the descendants were the serpent people after the flood that started their civilizations. I don't find it a coincidence that North American indigenous tribes have mythologies and legends about witches and ghosts and demons and serpents and lake monsters and sea monsters and giants and vampires and little people and mermaids and on and on and on. Those are worldwide, global, consistent mythologies. And so although I haven't spent a ton of time researching the Yeti or the Bigfoot or the Sasquatch or the Elma, I find it absolutely fascinating, and I would, love to have more time to spend more time on it. I just haven't really gone down that path in significant detail.
And I appreciate your feedback on it. When I think of the Nephilim, like what you and I have been talking about, I think of higher intelligence and basically people wanting and beings through bloodline wanting to rule the earth and have ruled the earth in the past and are still ruling the earth now. But what's weird about with Sasquatch is people have found like scat and hair, some physical remnants of them after an encounter or footprints, or, they've seen them break trees and they seem to be more ape-like, more monkey-like in their behaviors. But you're right. It is across the board. I mean, China calls them the Urans. Every culture has a name for them. And it does get kind of frustrating after a while when we can't seem to kill one and bring it in. And what's even more interesting about that is there's been so much government cover-up with it. I mean, I've talked to people in the government that will be first to tell you there's some sort of cover-up going on. It's interesting, though. You're right. It is in every culture.
One of those things that you just can't ignore when it's that prevalent throughout pretty much all cultures of the world. Again, it seems to reach across and affect so much of a similar narrative to so many other things that are going on. And if it is being covered up, what would be the point of that? It obviously would not necessarily be that there's this other being. It's the next questions that lead after that people don't want to have asked. I think that the people are going to find that the book is extraordinarily well-researched, and I'm not just making things up as they go, but I tie all of that research in, and it continually moves in a direction where you're going to understand the language of the entertainment today, and you're going to understand the roots of it. And for Christians in particular, they're going to really understand the language of their end-day prophecy. But if you want to know all aspects about the vampire mythos that's out there today, if you want to know about all aspects of the fairy culture, fairy tales, fair folk, Tuatha De Nann, King Arthur, and all of those connect, if you want to talk about or learn about all about why there's dragons and serpents, and if you want to learn about how all of these tales that weave through even places like Shakespeare, you're going to want to read this book. But it's one of those books that is it's like 98 different stories. And so it's done in a way that it is a long read, but you can leave it and come back. But it will build on each of those stories as the book develops, and it will all come back into play once or twice or several times down the road, not in a redundant factor, but when it comes up and how it's relative to what's being talked about at that point in time. I think people find it a fascinating journey.
Yeah, and I highly recommend everyone get the book. This whole topic is very fascinating in the sense that if you just look at all the different cultures throughout the world and you start drawing, connecting the dots between the Egyptians and some of the tribes talked about in the Bible, and it's all the same story being told over and over and over again, like with Greek mythology and the fallen angels, and it's all the same story being told over and over and over again. And so the whole topic is fascinating to me. I mean, and I hope the audience will go out there and get the book. For everyone out there listening, go get the book. It's by Gary Wayne, The Genesis 6, How Secret Societies and Their Descendants of Giants Plan to Enslave Humankind. Gary, I can't thank you enough for coming on.
I appreciate it, and have me back anytime.
I will.
Okay, appreciate it.
Someone is a human inviter.